Okay, this is continuing with Gordon Stanley on 12th August 1981. In the first 3 years of Owens Valley, what would you say are the primary scientific results that came out of it?
Well, I think those 3 years were probably the most exciting of any time in radio astronomy, or should have been. But to me, I think I was getting a little bit stale. I mean, I'd seen so much which I thought was impossible. But there's no question what the most exciting things were in those years: the brightness distribution work of Moffat and Maltby. The identification work, and it's pretty hard to pin anybody down on that one. Although I felt myself I was in a bad position. The identification work caused a lot of problems at Caltech, as I think it was Guido Munch said to me. Guido was very much a realist, and he said to me, Gordon, he said, I'm not getting into this identification business. He said, I can see all these people falling over themselves to become famous. But I had to resolve so many battles over the identification business that it became very unpleasant.
Do you mean scientific battles over the correct identification, or whether you have how much confidence you could have?
Who got credit?
Or who got credit?
Who got credit for what? I mean, they were sort of being handed out, like, you know, bad.
The positions were being handed out.
Right. And also the attitude, too, at Caltech was that the people who used the 200 inch are the people who were far more important. And some of the radio. Well, I wasn't involved in the identification per se myself at all. I felt badly for some of the other people who were actually doing the work out the Owens Valley.
Like Tom Matthews.
And lots of people like that. So I got a little bit done down the road on some of that stuff.
Yeah. But these were all, we were talking about the important results, so the identifications.
The planets, of course.
The Jupiter.
The Jupiter business, the Venus, of course, as well. Jupiter was a continuing story for a number of years. And,
what about the question of, we've already brought the point that they were movable, but Earth's rotation synthesis was not being thought about.
Right.
It was simply a matter of getting a visibility curve, is that correct?
Yes.
It has been said that Caltech should have jumped on this in 60-61. They had it there, and they missed the chance, essentially. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that. I think that's, if anybody's made that criticism, it's made without looking at the facts. We did jump on it. As I said, there was a proposal put out in 60-61 for an instrument that would have done, which was recommended by the Whitford Committee.
Mm-hmm.
The money was never forthcoming. I would say rather, I don't know why, and a number of people have asked me why it wasn't forthcoming, but it's not clear whether it was opposition within Caltech, which tends to be a monolithic sort of society, or whether it was some difficulty with the government funding of that project.
Certainly that would have been a much more easier system to do this, but with two dishes one can do the synthesis also. Right, so I mean this was not necessary to...
Well, I think that criticism's absurd, because within the limits of the sensitivity of the system, that's all the system was doing in the years between 61 and 66. Mm-hmm. It was doing synthesis, and there's lots of papers published to prove it as well.
Yeah, I guess not.
It was not extended.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. It's not directly Earth's rotation in the sense of looking at a source for 12 hours and putting it all together, but you were taking cuts at many different spacings, at many different angles, and trying to understand the structure of the sources. It just wasn't quite put together in the same fashion as it was in Cambridge.
Well,
do you think that's fair to say? Or?
Yes, but I think the contributions of the Owens Valley in that period were as great as Cambridge's were. Cambridge, they were doing an entirely different sort of thing. I mean, the double source story, which was extremely important, took a heck of a lot of telescope time. The identification, which was equally important, took just as much telescope time. It was nearly impossible to get time on the telescopes in those days. They worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. it was difficult for me to even find observers. We were not a national facility. We were supplied...
Oh, you mean operators, professional operators?
We didn't have professional operators. We used students.
Right.
We were not a national facility, and yet we got the largest fraction of the national budget in astronomy at that time. I just don't think it's a valid criticism.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. And we put in a proposal to get in a larger system, which we never got the money for. We got one dish, 130-foot dish.
The double sources are interesting. Is it fair to say that through the late 50s, you had Cygnus A, you had Centaurus. Those were two known doubles.
Yeah.
But it was not recognized at all that this would be a general class of thing.
No question. I mean, that was sort of out of the blue. The two stories came together. Manchester came out with a statistical picture that sources would double, but the Moffat-Morphy work showed indeed that it was a function of sources. It showed where the identification centroid should be and things like that. I'm amazed at that criticism.
Well, I've heard several people say it. To me, it's a bit of hindsight.
I'm resentful this time they say Caltech should have jumped on the bandwagon. I suppose it's a personal criticism for me that I didn't raise the money to get the extra instrument. That's what I needed. I mean, I argued violently. But we were passing through a political period at that time, and I guess we're going even more that way, where people who know me know what I did at that time. There was a move towards national facilities.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the right thing. But as many people have said, that Pasadena subtends a very small angle when viewed from Washington. And of course, the same story. I can make that same criticism more validly of the Palomar Observatory, of the Hale Observatories, because the Hale Observatory sat there very complacently for years, thinking that nobody's likely to build anything which is large and is as powerful as they are. And then all of a sudden, found here was Kitt Peak, upstart, with a much better engineering staff.
Yeah.
And I kept on hammering away at Jesse and the other people there and saying, for God's sake, you've got to upgrade your engineering. Oh, no. Telescopes and black boxes, astronomers just sit there.
So anyway, the immediate thing was...
But they did after a while, and then they had a bit of a disaster, and I don't know how they're going now, but I believe they might be doing a lot better.
Well, but you were talking now about 70s, I guess, when you say they did after a while.
Sure.
That's another thing that I've heard several comments on that's always amazed me, is the incredibly low level of electronic backing, so to speak, in the Hale Observatories.
That's correct.
Even despite the fact they had a radio observatory as an example.
Well, they didn't like us in that way, and I kept on telling them that they needed it, but they sort of smugly said, well, they didn't really smugly say anything. They were quite happy to keep on going, not realizing that they were being passed by a much smaller instrument.
Keep taking place and so on.
But then there was the other problem with Carnegie Institute, of course, too. It had a policy of not accepting government funds, which I think was reversed finally during the administration of Horace Babcock.
Yeah. Okay, one final question, a general one, which actually sort of relates to what we're saying now. What do you see as the major impact of radio astronomy on astronomy as a whole, up until this era now, the early 60s, either in terms of techniques or astronomical knowledge? In other words, the sort of the big picture, how has it really changed?
Well, I suppose... If you want me to come up with an original comment on that, I'm not going to be very original. It's very obvious.
What the major
impact of radio astronomy has been is on cosmology. When I first came to Caltech, I was working in that period on Palomar Mountain, Milt Humason, who was sort of carrying on the heritage of Hubble, who he'd been a protege of.
Right.
Was using up huge slabs of 200-inch time looking at field galaxies in the hope that one of them had very large redshifts. There's no question that in the interconnection between astronomy and radio astronomy, that's the most important factor of the whole lot. And I don't think, as I commented just a few minutes ago, to some extent it hurts a little bit that the optical astronomers themselves don't seem to realize that. astronomy is an experimental science. Radio astronomy is an experimental science. It took a great deal of technology to get the precisions and innovations to get the precisions that we realize now. Sure, it's a technological matter now. It's just a matter of telling a person how to do it and you do it. But it wasn't. You had to get there first.
Are you speaking in the present tense when you say that optical astronomy still has that attitude today, or were you talking about...
I was talking about then.
Then, that's what I wanted.
I was talking about my time, yes.
So I really get the impression then that you felt there were two camps. I mean, there was they and us.
No question.
Yeah.
It wasn't a question of feeling it. It was that.
And even someone like Minkowski...
Minkowski was not like that.
He was exceptional.
No, Minkowski and Bailey. Were not like that. I went to one stage when you were talking about whether about what Caltech should have done. Well, I made a lot of moves on that, and as I said, I went through all the committees, and one of the things I thought of finally, I thought, well, heck, I feel this division between the optical and the radio astronomy, so I feel it's astronomy, optical astronomy is a gentleman's game, or was a gentleman's, it's no longer that way. That's one of the things that's changed, and I think Kit Thing has probably done that. They feel this is sort of rather scruffy. It's sort of a bit suspicious, like when Jesse went to look at Reaver's installation.
Right.
A little bit suspicious of what these guys do. They're somewhat charlatans. But I thought, well, it's only sensible. I thought, if we're having this trouble, why not put the radio observatory under the control of the Hale Observatory? So I went to Ike Bowen. I said, okay, I said, I don't want to particularly be director. I'd like to see this go. I think you have to build this instrument if you want to stay there. There's a point where you're over the hill.
That's interesting. And what year was this, roughly?
When did Ike? It must have been the last year he was director before Horace took over. It was very shortly before he retired as director. So you can pinpoint it that way.
But this was after you were director, so this is after Bolton left.
Sure, well after Bolton.
Oh, I see. So this is late 60s.
Well, Bolton never had, John never had that power to do that. That was the whole point.
You had a different terms of reference in that aspect.
Well, I was director. I was almost completely autonomous.
I see.
I was answerable only to the program.
And Bolton's title wasn't even director?
No.
I see. Sort of the chief scientist at the...
Barker. Barker was principal investigator.
Oh, I see.
There was a principal investigator and Barker was it.
Oh, I see.
That's how it was set up.
Okay, well, unless you think there's something else that you'd like to speak to.
No, unless you think there's something else.
We have covered it very well. Thank you.
That ends the second interview with Gordon Stanley on 12th August 1981 at the IRSI in Washington, D.C. The first one was held 7 years ago in 1974 at Owens Valley. It'll be interesting to compare the two, see how they come out.